back to the Wamadai podcast, and I'm happy to say that we have another friend, an amazing human being, George Gashara. I've known him for quite a very, very, very long time, but I'll let him introduce himself, and then we can go from there.
You really don't throw me under the bus. I'm used to a trumpet, and then someone says, introduce me, and then now I come with a chest. I am George Gashara, and I'm very, very excited to be here with you today. I've also known you for a long time. We're almost doing a decade of knowing each other. And I'm quite proud of what you've been doing for this sector. And your social journey. I don't know what I should say about myself. Is there a format you prefer?
No, there's no format. Actually, the basic reason why we're here is to talk about your work.
Okay.
Supporting the creative industry, what you've been able to achieve, etc. The weirdest thing is that when and most people don't know this, is that you're an actual author.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
How did we start there?
Yeah,
I know.
and I hope it wouldn't be a TED talk. But this is the thing. I think that my journey of being a citizen is my journey of my work.
Mm.
And I don't think of myself pretty much as a creative, but just as a person who exists and tries to deal with the curveballs that Kenya is. And some curveballs are amazing, that a 23-year-old can publish a book, get some cash and move out from their mother's house, and then later realize that they were creative in that process. And that why the book is not successful is because Kenya, you can't distribute it, But I think what I would say is that I am an entrepreneur. I am a creative.
Yeah.
I'm also a community leader in some sort.
Yeah.
And I think I am a Kenyan and an African. And I think all those things define the work that I do in this place. So... I guess so that this story is dynamic, should be why I wrote a book at 10 or 11 years ago. So my dad has been my guardian, who I call my dad, is a reader. And so growing up, we read together.
Yeah.
Like the only way we would bond is that he would buy two newspapers. There was his and there's the one for the family. And then the rest of the siblings would come and take spots, Young Nation. And then by the time I'm getting the newspaper, it's just sijui what a guy was saying about Constitution. For a kid, I'm like, yo, I just have to read words and words and words and at least capture some things so that I can have a conversation with Dad.
Mm.
And so when Robert Shula is playing, there's this thing that he used to watch. There's a very conservative... television program.
Yes, I remember.
Preaching that would happen on Sunday evening in this very conservative American church. So that's the only stuff he would watch on TV. And then we would go into discussing what the newspaper said and what my opinion was. And so I think early on, I started creating a very strong opinion on current affairs, on the place of young people in this space. The stuff people would leave me with is the analysis part of the newspaper. And so I started having an opinion about culture, started having an opinion about writing. And so I guess that's how I started to build my sense of being. And then I was frustrated by education. And so I thought, I go to class, I went to a particularly religious school, university, so to speak, and most of our lecturers were older women who had probably had a career, but then went and did a doctorate.
Mm.
And so the first 30 minutes of every conversation in class was about their life and their view of society and their view through a Christian lens.
Mm.
And I always found it a bit unsatisfying, because I felt that there were many other views about the same subject and that those were not tolerated in this learning context.
Yeah.
And my imagination of school and society was that it was supposed to be open and that you could critique anything. And they found me rather difficult. And so that's, I think, the instigation of my writing journey.
Yeah.
So I published a book, and I think I wrote 20,000 words. And yeah. I felt like I'd said something. And then Njoki Ngumi, who's been my friend for many years, yeah. edited me and cut it down to a pamphlet. and since then, I think I got introduced to the world of thought, the yeah. world of production and creativity. Mm. And I've existed there both as a person, as a career, in my career for the last 15 years.
How did your initial experience as a creative feed into what you're doing now?
So I entered in the creative space through two routes. The first route was a community building activism space, and another one was falling in love.
Mm-hmm.
The best ways to enter the art, because I think the others are contentious. So coming to self, I think I was an active young person. I was always involved in something or the other that's happening in the country.
Yeah.
But there was the post-election violence.
Yeah.
Which I think was a nexus of my consciousness, but also my coming to self in adulthood.
Mm.
And I'd done some creative things, but without thinking of them as creative things, as hustles. So I did, the first time there was SMS campaigning in this country, this is pre-Facebook.
Yeah.
Because I know now there's Cambridge Analytica on the other end of Facebook.
Yeah.
But before then, we used to send SMSs, bulk SMSs. So I offered a service to a leading candidate.
Yeah.
And so they would speak to the president, this is the number.
Mm.
And it would be on newspapers. And the guy at the back texting back all these questions was me. So I was literally forming public opinion. And responding on behalf of a presidential candidate.
Mm.
And so I started to realize the medium of story, the medium of thinking, the medium of digital content, so to speak, was a place that I was enjoying building a proficiency and making some money.
Yeah.
And so that ended up at the Waki Commission.
What?
I was not asked to go to the ICC, thank God. But that is where the road of that inquiry ended up. And I think because of that, I met people like Boniface Mwangi, who was using the medium of photography to tell social issues.
Stories, yeah.
And at the time, I think I saw him on TV receiving a global award from CNN. And I was like, this guy is interesting.
Yeah.
And because of how life works, we ended up doing a project, which for me was one of the most significant introduction to Kenya, because we did Picha Mtaani for 3 years.
Yes, yes, I remember, yes.
I think, I guess, meeting him and finding that he had done this book with Go Down, which was called, I think, Unbowed or Kenya Burning or something like that. Kenya Burning as an artistic project, but then our work made Kenya Burning a national reconciliation project, putting photographs across the country in public cities, in public spaces in cities across the country.
And he still does it, by the way. It's still ongoing. It's still ongoing. Yeah, I go to like some creative events and I see it.
Okay, and I'm glad that at least we birthed something together, and I guess my contribution was to make the use of photography a public engagement. We were creating ground zeros in different cities where people would actually look at themselves and see out of this tapestry of stories, they are protagonists, you know. In Nakuru, we were arrested because we were told we are inciting. In Eldoret, we were threatened by the people who saw themselves as being misunderstood by the photographs. So we were told we are bringing uncultural to show death in Eldoret. In Kisumu, we were told we needed permission from Baba. It was really interesting dealing with Kenyans.
Yeah.
But what taught me is that Kenya has reformed a lot of its laws, but we have done very little in culture.
True.
We have not had significant conversations about being And so sometimes you introduce people to their mirror image and they're confounded by that image. And I was too young to realize what we were doing. But actually quite bold. And I had the right partner to do that crazy project with. And so we did Pichantani. And out of that, I started to realize that there's a cultural work that needs to be done in this country so that then we can find ourselves, we can find what we call nation. And then later I realized that the cultural workers are amongst the most misunderstood people, and that there are no institutions or support systems around the cultural worker. We have institutions around the farmer. We have institutions around the teacher. We have institutions around the social worker or the preacher. But we don't create an institutions around the artists. And so then that has been my exploration for quite a number of years.
So I know you as a thinker and a connector of ideas. Even sometimes, you know, like ideas that, you know, I haven't myself even, you know, started thinking of, but then, you know, here's George with all these, you know, amazing ideas. Now, you've brought in this this thing about cultural workers not having a support system. What then drove you to take the next step, which is not only just support them, but also try create ecosystems, and also funding. What drove the whole process?
Well, I'd say, and there was a quote: "As one person knows more about their, and then they find her." I don't have the specific quote in my mind, but as you realize, I mean, there's interest. When you have interest, you're an outside observer.
Yeah.
And then you become a professional.
Yeah.
You start to see the things clearly.
Yeah.
And then when you become an expert, then you start to identify problems and actually you get involved in fixing a thing. And so my journey has been, after quite a number of years, is that going deeper and deeper, I start to realize different things. And I think I'm still at the early part of this journey. I don't know where it takes us, but I know my current question that I'm dealing with, previously I've dealt with different questions. I've dealt with the question of creating language for my generation to engage in culture. And we did the work with the Nest, dealing with numerous topics, whether it's fashion, to inclusion, to aesthetics. Later, we dealt with the question of identity. And so we've done films, music, and all manner of work around that. Some notorious, some successful. But a critical question.
Some banned.
Yes, notorious. I chose a very...
I think at least we can say that.
Yes, it was banned. Yeah. But I actually think of it as exile.
Yeah.
Because I feel that... In our cultural context in this country, we've seen time and time again when the public and the cultural space does not allow some type of conversations. We've seen an exodus of that kind of work or the creators to go to other places. And when we are ready, they come back home. So this particular film is in exile. It's probably one of the most successful Kenyan films. I'd rather say it's shown in 158 countries, won over 12 different awards, and it broke even. Like I don't know about films in this country that break even, but that one has. So it's a successful film project, but it's an unsuccessful cultural work because of the cultural context. But then other than that, the question of artistic livelihoods has never been dealt with comprehensively, or rather in a way that addresses some questions but continues to deepen the inquiry. So back in 2013, other than the question of cultural expression, we wanted my generation, the people who have a skill, but it's outside of the creative industries, but they have a talent and an interest in the creative industries, we wanted at the time to allow them to have more hours to spend within the creative industries. And at the time, the only sector that was paying successfully was the advertising sector, mm-hmm. but it was also as damaging as it was, as it continues to be for creatives.
Hey, I think we need a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think I'm the most eloquent person for this one. Hey, I think you'll find another. You'll have to find another guest.
No problem.
But as far as we're concerned, at the time, the inquiry was, how do we give creatives more time? Because at the time, the writer who works at the bank, there's a medical doctor who's a playwright. There's an engineer who is a sculptor. Yeah. So how do we create an environment where they can spend 2 more hours in the week, three more hours, and eventually they can transform to spending 8 hours a week or 40 hours a week if they wanted. Yeah. And so the question was livelihoods at the beginning. And so we realized, how do you create livelihoods by paying better? How do you pay better? By creating industries. How do you create industries? By creating SMEs that integrate to create an industry. How do you support SMEs? By cash flow, business support. How do you create cash flows? So we kept building the inquiry. Mm. And along with it, the tools. At the beginning, we thought, a savings plan would be better. Oh, but we realized, these guys don't earn. And if they earn, it's hand to mouth. So there's very little savings. Yeah. And so then, so we said guarantee fund. So we were like, but we realized that we would need to have cash and give it to the banks who are unwilling to lend to this sector. So it wasn't going to be a guarantee fund. So we're like, so let's build. So and all this time we're investing in these tools. So we pay lawyers and all these people to create this thing. But then we realize, this is not going to work in our current ecosystem. Either the economy is too... anyway, long story, we arrived at a hybrid fund.
Okay.
And at this fund, the last 7 years have been an interesting journey. It's been an interesting journey of learning who we are, who is a creative, where does the money, how does the money flow within the creative industries, how to make it work, how to make money work for the creatives. And then we realize actually the problem is not money. The problem is everything else that keeps the money away. And that starts from our cultural attitudes, our risk appetite, our prejudices around what is creative work, our consumption habits, the structures around consumption habits. And because of that, then now we have a full-time job chipping at this every day.
Interesting. And so why the name Hiva Fund? I've always wondered.
Okay.
Because one, you know, creative organizations have interesting names.
Mm-hmm.
Kuona Trust. Mm-hmm. They go down.
Mm-hmm.
Hiva Fund for me sounded different. More like, not like a bank, but like, but like a bank in space that, you know, I mean, that gives you like, that gives you a specific type of money that you can buy in, you know, in Mars, or like a buy stuff. Anyway, sorry.
To be honest, we've thought of a cryptocurrency called Hiva.
What? I was not wrong.
and don't worry, it's copyrighted and we have the trademarks. So
at least you can talk eventually about it,
But anyway, in terms of looking at creating the name, there were numerous things that we needed to address. First, you needed a name that has no association with anything. If you say shoe fund, there's a shoe fund somewhere in the world. If you want a spoon fund or culture fund. So just so that we can have our website.
So
we had an entire notice board with phrases that were around our vision, the things that we desire.
Yeah.
And one phrase actually worked.
Yeah.
And at our 10th year anniversary, which is, I think, 3 years out, we will reveal what this phrase is. Wow. So until then...
we'll do another podcast then.
In 2023, hopefully, because I'm not allowed to reveal this phrase.
No problem.
However...
Yes, go on.
The idea of the fund was to create a flexible platform that would allow us to interact with the knowledge and the sensitivity that we know about the creative industry, because we've published books, we've written articles, we've done fashion, music, film. So we are aware. We are completely involved in artistic creation, but also mediate with the commercial sector, using the logic of commercial sector and translate our values. And so we created an institution that can speak finance and speak art eloquently at the same time.
I've always found it interesting that the Ministry of Culture, for instance, the work you're doing is under the Ministry of Culture. But what this culture, well, this cultural economy, what the creative economy is actually an economy, so it's trade. What do you think needs to happen so that at a policy level we have a better support system and a better understanding that this is not just craft. This is actually an economic activity, and based on that, it gets way more support than it's getting currently, in my opinion.
Well, and this is work that we've tried to do for the last 5 years. It's a question of an analysis. In the last 3 or 4 years, we've talked about blue economy in this country. There's a massive economy conference where they spent a lot of money telling us about what blue economy is. And it's nothing new. It's just a logic, an organizing logic around fisheries and the resources underwater. And I think there's a part of government that is complex enough to think about the intersection of industries that make the blue economy. We've heard of the green economy, which is everything between energy, sustainable livelihoods, and industry. And the country is sophisticated enough to create a unifying logic around the green economy. What I struggle with is that on a daily basis, we interact with the creative industries, from the clothes we wear, from the furniture we use, the toys that our children use, the music that we listen to. Everything around our non-professional life is purely in the creative industries, but we refuse to accept a sophisticated logic to say that on one hand, there's cultural production, and on the other hand, there is innovation. And all of this allow us to meet at a place we can call a creative industry.
Yeah.
And sometimes you say creative industry, and someone says a painter. And I'm like, a painter is the entry level sometimes in the creative industry, because they can paint on canvas, but the same person can paint on virtual backgrounds to create the mountain landscapes behind Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And that's a Kenyan who lives at Loreshon, literally, who made the backgrounds of Game of Thrones, called Mueni, that I've met a couple of times, but no one understands the complexity and the money, or refuses to accept. And I'll give you another example that is ubiquitous in Kenya.
Yeah.
The M-Pesa journey, which is now the same as Mount Kenya and Maasai. When you put Mount Kenya, Maasai, M-Pesa, Kenya is complete, and a bit of marathon there, is literally the same journey, that someone said that there can be a virtual network that's managed and democratic and that moves money between people. And someone said, it can happen in Kenya. Let's find a way of accepting this complex analysis of money transfer.
Yeah.
And now it's an app that moves 3 times our GDP every day.
Yeah.
You know, and someone accepted that complex logic and created a legal framework for it, checks and balances, and allowed it to flourish.
Yeah.
So what we are saying is that the creative industry for us, first, is the only place other than agriculture that creates new things in this economy. Everyone else is a trader.
Yeah.
Ask me who is creating anything in this economy. Only farmers
yeah.
who take a seed
yeah.
Sometimes wait for God because I don't know about fertilizer and rain. And farming is riskier than creative industry.
True.
Because you are relying on things that are older than yourself, like the climate.
I mean, and then also locusts. I mean, also there are other things.
Yeah.
That happen. I mean,
but as a country, we've understood a farmer, even if as at a small scale level, requires a fertilizer, requires some credit and transport so that we can say we are a horticultural country.
Yeah.
And it's small scale farmers. But we struggle to understand that shirts, we wear shirts in this country. Yeah. Everyone has a white shirt in their wardrobe. A white shirt.
Yeah.
Everyone has it.
Yeah.
But then we empower the economy of Southeast Asia in our wardrobes across the country. Everyone has socks.
Mm.
That should be made here.
True.
Or at least half of everyone's socks. Someone should have a pair from Kenya.
Yeah.
That's how we create an industry. So we think about a pair of socks for school. Let's even leave for office.
Mm.
Because nowadays I see people having the colorful one. That's yellow, red, whatever, whatever. It's complex. Gray with a stripe of blue and a stripe of white.
Yeah.
If we would make sure that school uniform socks are all made here, would immediately employ over 70,000 people directly. And indirectly, the people who transport it, the people who yarn the fibers, the people who grow the fibers, the people who market that, the people who package that, the people who make sure that the shops are open and they are clean, it would be a massive economy just safeguarding one thing, schools' socks.
Yeah.
Now think about everything else from pencils to rubber to books to play toys to spectacles. Imagine we just to masks. Because and that's the thing.
True.
I feel that the understanding of that it sits in culture. I think some components are in culture because again there's a culture for public good.
Yeah.
Some things sit with the Attorney General because some are patents. If someone decided
IP,
that this sweater has a unique stitch, because you have it, inside is Ankara, outside is a real sweater.
Yeah.
If someone decided to patent that, it will sit with the AGs.
Yeah.
Some of it is in industry. If it interacts with your skin, we have to have some standards and how that feels.
Kids,
and for children, some sit with industry. Others sit with ICT, because if you're watching ViewSasa, that is ICT and communication.
Mm.
Part of it sits with museums. So we need an integrated approach that says that this is an industry that has numerous players. Some players are cultural, like we have the Maasai beads.
Mm.
But the Maasai beads, we import that stuff from Indonesia. The beads are no longer made here. Maasai people, women in Samburu require Mombasa port to work for them to express themselves culturally. But then also,
horrible.
Even after the beads have arrived, no one has ever patented the coding that goes, that's been passed down from centuries of centuries and centuries around how they arrange those beads. How do we just look at it and say, oh, it's beautiful? But at the end of the day, that's intellectual property.
That's true.
That we could transpose it to cars, to buildings, to... Now, that's where the creative industry comes.
There's a lady actually who painted a car
in South Africa.
In South Africa, So, and I'm thinking about, what you're saying about transferring some of this knowledge. Because that could be a design for a building.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a design for, and then these are the people who are going to make money from that because their IP has been protected. And I feel that, like you've reiterated, that I feel that even the basics here are not, even the basics here are not sorted. And the people who suffer the most are the entry level people, because once they create something, some person from some Asian country or whatever will come here, will copy it, and then resell it to us at a obviously cheaper price. And the person who created this thing does not get anything.
And I think the last part of this analysis is that even some of it sits in agriculture, yeah. and another sits in medicine. Because
how does that work?
Agriculture. Yeah. If you look at nail polish for women or men or anyone who polishes their nails, the color pigment comes from Taita Taveta. We grow some seeds that they are the only types of this seed that grow only in this part of the world, and we sell abroad. And then we import it in lipstick and whatever. And it's a pigment that grows there. What's if you think about our genes, if you want to weather your genes to look cool, you go either the enzyme that does weathering of genes comes from Thika or Baringo. These are enzymes that God gave us. You just go to the water, collect it, go to a laboratory, multiply it. I won't mention their names. They have become billionaires because they come here with tourist visas. They go and take our enzyme and then they go and patent it outside there. And it is here. And it's an intellectual property. The other part of cultural heritage that we have is medicinal value. Our trees, like the Africana prunus, has the one pigment that sorts out questions of prostate cancer globally.
Yeah.
If you go across, even cows love Africana prunus. In Sotik, I was told recently that the entire stock of trees does not have bugs because people have over-harvested, because we don't know. Only a few people know, and they traffic on this stuff.
Oh.
We have so much cultural value, but we waste it because we do not have a sophisticated logic to look at the breadth of the creative industries.
And support it.
And finally, around my analysis of the creative industries, is that our continent and our country has amongst the youngest people in the world. Mm-hmm. Our median age, is it median or the other one? When you add everyone in.
So, I mean, average age
is 19.
Yeah.
So if you think about capital accumulation, skills building, technical skills of a 19-year-old, you realize that's very young. If you compare to other ecosystems like South Africa, their median age is 27. So if you think about capital accumulation, skills building and all that stuff, age of industry, they are a more mature space. So here we are very at entry level.
Yeah.
So what do you need at an entry level? Because people are like, oh, there's not enough money, but we want to give jobs. So it's a startup space. It's people who have basic entry skills. That's the majority of our demographic, you know? And so then how do you create an industry that grows together with its population? Because sometimes I think that we plan for our ideal selves, not our actual selves. The creative industries allows talent at the very beginning. And talent is available across our demographic. And as people mature and as we become older as a country, then people will be able to exploit more sophisticated things. So we need to think about training. We need to think about tooling. We need to think about very basic entry-level stuff that allows everyone with talent to start to build a career, to start to create, and therefore eventually then we'll have a very sophisticated creative industry that not only that 19-year-olds in Lamu are able to make those doors, but are also able to transfer that pattern onto fabric and to virtual worlds and into vehicles and to other industries.
Movies, CGI. Like
the boat making industry should be exporting not only the boats themselves, but the concept of that skill,
true.
Not only in the region, but to the world, but also transferring those skills and dispersing them so they can go into other practices.
Yeah.
So I firmly believe that if we are going to solve the question of jobs in this country, we're going to solve the question of cultural heritage and belonging, if we're going to solve the question of this idea of citizenships, that people feel that they have a role in a city, in a town, in a country. It's through creative industries because it allows you to produce from where you are, and then we get sophisticated as we go. Hey, I don't want nobody thinking that I'm here to make a fuss. I'm here to make good music, here to make it last, here to make my people.